Hi, welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your editor for the evening, John Larson. Tonight's podcast will be a recording of our first live lecture we recorded on September 7th, 2011 in Salt Lake City at the Downtown Library. Our guest speaker for the evening was Will Bagley. And one of the requests he had before he came and presented the lecture, which he graciously did, was that we create a lecture series and name it after Dale Morgan. Dale Morgan was a prominent Utah historian who dealt with issues in Western history and Mormon history and just the whole broader apparatus out here. And he passed away in 1971, but he was a mentor to Will and somebody who Will looked up to as a great historian. Will Bagley's lecture, named after Dale Morgan, is The Sharpest Thorn, Life on the Borderlands of the Mormon West, in which Will discusses how Morgan and other great Utah historians shaped his career and helped revolutionize Mormon and Western frontier history. There's a lot of names that you'll hear that are really some of the pioneers of Western and Mormon history, and there's some really great gems that Will brought out for the evening. We were really grateful for him to agree to this, and we'll get started. One last production note, Tom Perry arranged for this and really did all the footwork on it, and I'm ever grateful to him. He also did the introduction. Unfortunately, we had some technical difficulties with the recording, and we lost the first few minutes of Tom's introduction and some of Will's talking about his friend Morgan. For that, we apologize profoundly. We did capture the beginning of his lecture and most of the questions at the end. So I hope you will enjoy, and here we go.
But for this lecture, a sense that time is growing short inspired me to look back. For more than half my 61 years, I've wrestled with type 1 diabetes. Last June, I spent a very expensive night in Bismarck, North Dakota, at a hospital after having a mild thalamic ischemic attack while being in Bismarck to collect a runner-up spur for so rugged and mountainous, which I was, before I left the hospital to go collect the award, they informed me by the insurance company had no plans to pay for the $10,000 bill, even though I pay $1,250 out of pocket in health insurance every month. Partly as a result of the medication I'm taking, I hope, for the first time in my life, I feel old, stupid, and fat. But I remain oddly confident I'll finish my great works, the Overland West Tetralogy and the Kingdom in the West series, but it still feels like the end is nigh. Then again, I never expected to live to be 21 and have expected to drop dead momentarily ever since. If you average how long my great-grandfathers lived, I should survive well into the 2040s. But mortality is a perilous enterprise, and death always lurks 6 feet to the left. As Hank Williams observed, nobody gets out of this world alive. Dale Morgan didn't. Morgan died early in 1971, just shy of his 57th birthday, far too young. He left behind 20 original books or carefully edited works, plus nearly 50 articles and contributions, and untold other books for which he seldom got the credit he deserved. According to his biographer, Richard Saunders, his accomplishments made him one of the foundational figures in the historiography of the American West. To describe Dale L. Morgan as a prodigious researcher and writer is an understatement, wrote his friend Harold Schindler, his devoted apostle. Stricken as a youngster with meningitis, which robbed him of his hearings, he was fated to live in a silent world, alone with his thoughts and ambitions. His concentration was total. His ability to reason through the most difficult and complex array of data was immense. Morgan spent much of World War II at the National Archive transcribing the journals of Howard Stansbury's topographical expedition to Utah in 1849 and 1850. Furthermore, as a measure of Morgan's astonishing work ethic, Schindler pointed to the thousands of pages of typescripts from every article about Utah, the Mormons, and the West in the Library of Congress's huge newspaper file, which permitted him to write on virtually every aspect of Western history with an authority far above and beyond that of any other scholar. Now, not everyone would agree with my friend Hal's exalted tribute, but Morgan's contribution to Western history can be measured by his appearance in the acknowledgments of dozens, more likely hundreds, of the most important histories of his time. Morgan, quote, put every researcher and writer on both the Mormons in the West, the Far West, since him in his debt because of his far-ranging industry and his fabled generosity, his friend William Mulder wrote. Now, what the owner of Dale Morgan's house told me was that the bottom panel of that door to the bedroom was all scuffed up. And he said he'd been told that it was scuffed up because after Morgan suddenly went deaf at the age of 14, he would stand at the door, lean his head against the door, and kick the bottom panel as an expression of his frustration. Now, the accomplishments of Morgan's life and the, in many ways, tragic circumstances of his life and death are part of his, a part of what has made him a legend to those of us who practice the craft of Western history. And I've noted that when I began working in history about 25 years ago, he was preeminent among the historical stars of the Utah Westerners, a group of what Morgan's friend Fawn Brody called a bunch of Utah Jack Mormons, the only requirement to be a Utah Westerner was that you loved history, and therefore it included its members have included bank presidents, corporate directors, Dave Freed, Ken Garf, doctors, surgeons, a long, long list of accomplished people, but also a lot of bus drivers, ordinary working people, high school teachers, and scoundrels like Will Bagley. And now, thanks to the good efforts of a lot of the men I'm going to be talking about, we have opened our doors to membership by anyone with a interest in history, and that means we no longer discriminate against women. And everybody thinks that that's that's wonderful progress, except probably the ghost of Hal Schindler. Now, among the Utah Westerners, and I'll be talking about, as I said, about several of them, Dale's reputation was sterling. And we all looked to him as a model of how to be an effective researcher and an engaging writer. It's one thing that everyone in that group, I believe, shares is a commitment to telling the story of the West as well as possible in prose and stories that are going to engage people. And as I was doing the research for this, I came across some absolutely wonderful sentiments in that direction. I even brought, oh yeah, here we go. I brought a couple of copies of a piece that Schindler and I did with Brigham Dwayne Madsen. And Professor Madsen was another close friend of Dale Morgan's and actually finished Morgan's work on the Stansbury expedition. And he wrote this to talk about his experiences in the history of Utah. And it was it's an entirely engaging piece, and I'll be quoting from it. But one thing I didn't quote in the written talk was that he said that he believed you ought to tell history in an engaging narrative fashion. And the trend more and more in professional historical circles is to write less readable books about much narrower topics aimed at a handful of devout specialists. But what I've learned from my colleagues in the Utah Westerners is that this is people's history and you ought to write it for people. But after a lonely and emotionally frustrating life, Dale and an old friend, Louise North, fell in love after her husband Max died of cancer in 1964. 6 years later, a second Guggenheim Fellowship to write a history of the North American fur trade let Dale Morgan contemplate retiring from the Bancroft Library to join Louise at her hilltop home in Accokeek, Maryland, across the Potomac River from Mount Vernon. A wrenching abdominal pain awakened Morgan in September 1970. He finally went to see a doctor in November who diagnosed advanced metastasized colon cancer. Dale Morgan, the handicapped son of a poor widow, had always managed to, quote, land on his feet, and he felt that nothing, even cancer, could stop him, his friend Lois Stone wrote. Morgan moved to Maryland to be with Louise, hoping to recover and go to London to research his fur trade book by summer. But his last weeks became a downward spiral of cancer-induced weakness and lethargy. He died on March 30th, 1971. Dale L. Morgan was cremated, and his ashes now lie beneath a large tulip poplar overlooking the Potomac. His friend Wallace Stegner mourned the loss of a great scholar, but even more, the loss of so fine and decent and generous and long-suffering a man. I have long since ceased trying to figure out the whys of the universe, Winnie the Brooks said. I can only accept these tragedies with what grace I can muster. Now, Morgan considered his documentary histories of the West of William Ashley and Overland in 1846, Diaries and Letters of the Oregon-California Trail, his finest work. He was unhappy with Jedediah Smith and the opening of the West, which still stands as a masterwork of narrative history, and it's one of my favorite books. But it didn't hit that impeccable mark that Morgan set for his own work. He dramatically influenced the writing of two of the most important books ever written about Mormonism, Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History and Winnita Brooks's The Mountain Meadows Massacre. But Morgan never wrote the Mormon history trilogy he dreamed about. Along with his fur trade masterpiece, Morgan's history of the Latter-day Saints died with him. On that note, I will use this occasion to announce not one, but two new Dale Morgan books. They're additions to the Kingdom in the West series, which are those blue books. Volume 13, Playing with Shadows, Voices of Dissent in the Mormon West, which I edited with two fantastic scholars, Paul Aird and Jeff Nichols, will be out this fall, but that's long been known. The surprise is that Richard L. Saunders, editor of Eloquence from a Silent World, a descriptive bibliography of the published writings of Dale L. Morgan, has signed on to contribute two volumes titled Dale Morgan and the Mormons, Collected Works, 1939 to 1970, which will comprise, I hope, volumes 14 and 15 of the Kingdom in the West series. Now, I was delighted to enlist Bishop Saunders' services because he's about the best and brightest of his generation of Mormon scholars. I enjoy engaging experts from all kinds of perspectives, especially those who take a dramatically opposed view to my own naturalistic biases. And I know of no smarter defender of the faith than Richard Saunders, except perhaps Rick Turley. I hope Mormon Expressions will someday invite both of these gentlemen to give a Dale L. Morgan lecture. Now, in the Credo Albert Einstein recorded in 1932 for the German League of Human Rights, shortly before leaving Germany forever, Einstein said, "My life is based to such an extent on the work of my fellow human beings, I know how much I owe them." In this spirit, I want to salute a few mentors: Brig Manson, Dave Bigler, Hal Schindler, Floyd O'Neill, Greg Thompson, and Wilbur Bud Rusho, who all have interesting connections to Dale Morgan. Brigham D. Manson published Morgan's archival research as Exploring the Great Salt Lake, the Stansberry Expedition. When Dale Morgan was assembling west from Fort Bridger in 1950, which Hal Schindler and I updated in 1994, Dave Bigler helped Morgan gain access to his great uncle's diary, which Dave published in 1990 as the Gold Discovery Journal of Azariah Smith, a book that has provided a template for virtually everything I've ever written since. At the instigation of Hal Schindler, Greg Thompson helped the Bancroft Library process and microfilm all 76 boxes, 27 cartons, and 103 cubic feet of Dale's papers, now available at the Marriott Library Special Collections. And if you're interested in historical research on any topic about the American West, go through the register of that collection and you can find amazing sources. And his letters are some of the most engaging, knowledgeable, and fascinating explorations into Western history that you could ever hope to see. Now, not long after his retirement from the University of Utah, Professor Emeritus Madsen read my first perfectly awful historical essay and critiqued it with typical compassion. In his essay, The Craft of History, right here, which inspired Brig to write his wonderful autobiography, Against the Grain, he deliberately used the word craft to describe the discipline of history, because the craft required, like his other calling, carpentry, a special skill and careful attention to detail. One reason I probably clicked with Brig so well was that I was a member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, and Brig had been had quit his job at Brigham Young University as a history professor and went into general contracting with the Madsen brothers in about 1954 after he got tired of Ernest Wilkinson. When the Mormon History Association declined to consider Briggs Corinne, the Gentile capital of Utah, for an award because it was not Mormon history, even though it was about the struggle over the economic and political control of Utah, Brig joked about forming the Utah Gentile History Association, and then said he might form it, but he wouldn't join it because it would reflect a certain kind of bias. Madsen confessed he did not understand the point of view of some of my colleagues who view themselves as Mormon historians. Quoting one who announced he would tell the truth and nothing but the truth, but not necessarily the whole truth, Brig found the statement incomprehensible. "Which part of the whole truth is to be eliminated?" he asked. "In a court of law, would this historian declare that he intends to omit some essential information? Of such formulae, apologetic history is born." He pointed to a Mormon historian who devoted 14 pages to a discussion of the Utah War without once mentioning the Mountain Meadows Massacre. "I want no part of such sinning by omission," he said. Brig Madsen, who often said to me he wondered how much better his career might have gone had he not been saddled with such an unfortunate first name, remained a friend and inspiration until his death last Christmas Eve at the age of 96. He came up 1 year short of fulfilling prophecy, for his patriarchal blessing said he would live to be 97. Two younger historians, or a little bit younger historians, David L. Bigler and Floyd A. O'Neill, had by far the most influence on my career. With their patience and wise advice, both have been instrumental in making a better writer and scholar out of someone who started with very modest ambitions. They did this by asking questions that extended my interest in trails and Mormons to a bigger subject, American history. Dave Bigler has a singular genius to look at critical episodes in often analyzed events like the Utah War and the Bear River Massacre and see what other historians have missed and what is completely ignored in the standard treatments of the subjects. He does this by asking simple questions about key elements in the accepted historical mythology of the Mormon West. To focus on the Mormon Battalion's Battle of the Bulls, in which his great-grandfather, Albert Smith, was injured in 1846, as a significant event in itself, overlooks the important relationship that exists between this bovine encounter on southern Arizona's San Pedro River and President James K. Polk's plan to take over the region that now forms the American Southwest. The connection between the bullfight and manifest destiny lies in the answer to an obvious question, Dave wrote in 1995. Where did the bulls come from in the first place? Those belligerent bulls came from an 1822 Mexican land grant intended to create a buffer against Apache incursions. By 1846, the Apaches had converted Ignacio Perez's 73,240-acre ranch into their own game preserve, where they hunted the cattle left behind as they did any other game. Easiest to bring down safely were the cows and calves, which left the bulls to grow older, wilder, and more aggressive. That's why the Mormon Battalion found a whole army of bulls on the San Pedro River. It turned out that the Army of the West's most effective means of conquest, Bigler observed, was not muskets or money, but the promise to protect the inhabitants from hostile Indians. A pledge, he noted, that it took the United States 40 years to fulfill. Now, for further evidence of David Bigler's brilliance, I'll refer you to this book. It's my latest book. It has already been selected by the John Whitmer Historical Association as the for the Smith Pettit Award for Best Book of 2010-2011. And it is a very revisionist take on the history of what's often called the Utah War. I like to say it's the history of America's first armed Tea Party rebellion, but David, who is one of the only authentic Christians I've ever met, is also a devout right winger, and I am not. So he talks about some politics in here, but I held myself back in pointing out that if you wanted to find the scriptural origins of much Tea Party doctrine, you should look in the Journal of Discourses at the speeches, reports, and comments of Mormon prophet Brigham Young. But in that book, Bigler looked at an odd incident that's completely ignored in the standard histories, which was an attack by Bannock Shoshone Indians on the most northern Mormon outpost at Fort Limhi, which is named after a Book of Mormon king whose name is now misspelled in the name of the Limhi Indians and Limhi Pass and a whole range of other names. But he points out that that was what ended the Utah War, because when news of that attack reached Salt Lake, Brigham Young knew that his dreams of forming an alliance with the Indians wasn't going to happen. And at that moment, he completely reversed course overnight and canceled a message, or the news he'd given to Thomas Kane that he wasn't going to give the army anything, and immediately offered them 500 cows and a couple of tons of flour. Now, nobody had ever looked at the facts as presented in the executive documents of the United States and seen how dramatic a turnaround that was. But that is the reason the Mormon War ended peacefully, and not because of the great ministrations of a bunch of conniving politicians. Anyway, writers' lives are all anxiety and ambition, Martin Amis observed. No one begrudges them the anxiety, but the ambition is something they are supposed to shut up about. I started my career as what Floyd O'Neill calls a pothole historian with modest ambitions, hoping to dig a narrow and deep posthole in some obscure corner of Western history. I had adopted much of the mindset of my other mentor and collaborator, Hal Schindler. Like Dale Morgan, our hero, we were more interested in practical questions, straightening out the enormous distortions of the record, than in creating theoretical interpretations of what Hal often called big head history. Old Grizz, as his friends called Hal after his star turn in Rick Burns' film The Donner Party, suffered a fatal heart attack while preparing for another day's research at the Utah State Historical Society in 1998. He was still writing history in the hope that when people read his work, they would say, as they said of Dale Morgan, "So that's the truth of the matter." Floyd O'Neill inspired me to do better by telling an infinite number of stories, some for moral instruction, some of bravery, some illustrative of the foolish acts of men, while others were of lyrical beauty describing nature, as Floyd wrote in his section of The Peoples of Utah. Among the Utes, each storyteller and singer of songs had his own style and variation of which he was proud, and Floyd O'Neill definitely has his own style. A descendant of Irish rebels, French fur trappers, and Mormon farmers, Floyd had the fire in his blood that makes Utah history so interesting. While still in college, Dr. O'Neill's dissertation revolutionized the interpretation of the Great Basin's native history, an act of honesty, courage, and justice that got little respect from the state's historical establishment, but won Floyd legions of friends in the Uinta Basin, where he grew up, and at Ibapah, Kaibab, Kusharum, and Indian Peaks. A senior member of his department once said that Floyd would have done a lot better at the University of Utah if he hadn't been such a troublemaker, an indisputable fact. "Nobody likes a smartass," Floyd often warned me, advice I ignored at least as often as he did. I never appreciated how important a figure Floyd O'Neill had become as the director of the University of Utah's American West Center until I went to a Western History Association conference at Denver and watched the luminaries of Western history, old and new, line up to talk to him. Floyd once, as an aside, Floyd once told me that much to his aggravation, a senior member of the history department once warned him that unless you go a lot easier on Brigham Young, your career in Western history isn't going to go anyplace. And I could see when he told me the story how aggravated it made him. Well, we were having lunch at Crown Burger one day, and this was after I'd written Blood of the Prophets and he'd read it. I don't know if it had come out yet. He looked across the table at me and he said, "If you don't go a lot easier on Brigham Young, your career in Utah history isn't going to go anyplace." But beyond the mentoring, I owe Floyd even more personally, for in 1999, he introduced me to my wife, Nora Bear. Among his many talents, O'Neill has a genius for matchmaking. He once boasted he had arranged hundreds of marriages during his years at the American West Center. Like many of Floyd's stories, this sounds wildly improbable, but probably is true. After I began working on the Mountain Meadows Massacre in 1995, Professor O'Neill would take me out to lunch and patiently explain a host of complicated issues. When we traveled to Washington, D.C. on a research expedition, the senior staff at the National Archives greeted him like an old friend, which he was, and he showed me how to search the records in our national attic. Over the next 5 years, Floyd gave me a virtual graduate education in history and taught me how to deal with the contradictory and fabricated evidence cluttering up Mormonism's violent past. As he had done with dozens of graduate students, Floyd roundly rebuked my many attempts to, quote, stretch a rat's ass over a rain barrel. He also shared with me Juanita Brooks' answer to what is truth. Floyd knew Brooks for 25 years and only recalled her raising her voice once while speaking about Southern Utah history at the dedication of Glen Canyon Dam. When she asked for questions, a young man said, "Mrs. Brooks, you say you were a Mormon, but how could a good Latter-day Saint write a book like your Mountain Meadows Massacre?" "Young man," she said, "I am a Mormon. Mormonism is about truth and the whole truth. If you don't believe that, you're not a Latter-day Saint." Now, the new Western historians, Richard White, Elliot West, Patty Limerick, William Cronin, Clyde Milner, and Charles E. Rankin, have created a wider vision of the American past, one that has forged a more encompassing, engaging, colorful, inclusive, accurate, and honest history of the frontier borderlands than the old triumphal mythology of how Anglo-Protestant civilization conquered savagery and tamed a wild land. I am proud to be a revisionist historian. After all, if a historian is not expanding and reconsidering our understanding of the past, what's the point? Early in my career, I realized how much borderland history lay untouched in the vast records of the LDS Church, and how much these letters, journals, military reports, ecclesiastical records, and personal histories had to say about the entire West and the peoples of the borderlands, the French Indians and the Mexicans and mountaineers who ran the Rocky Mountain fur trade and the overland trading posts, Polynesians, overland sojourners and gold seekers, and especially Indians, Shoshones, Utes, Paiutes, Pavants, Bannocks, Goshutes, Navajos, and Hopis. My life works became sharing those historical treasures with everyone who loves the past. Richard Saunders takes a less worshipful and more complex view of Dale Morgan than Hal Schindler, while noting how much his work brought about a reformation in Western history. Interpreting the sweep of large cultural ideas or movements and comparative interpretation was foreign to Morgan, Saunders notes. Another shortcoming as a student of religious faith is that he had none. Because he could not accept faith, he could not account for it in others. Saunders identified Morgan's approach to history as philosophically positivistic and empirical, the perfect expression for a personal belief structure that was entirely naturalistic. This approach to history, a quest for what can be measured, plotted, and proven, proved to be Morgan's specialty. His specialty was getting at the facts. But in trying to explain the whys motivating Mormonism, he was unable to balance convincing explanation based on adequate detail and sought to, quote, interpret a religion by dismissing its claims. Now, I disagree profoundly with Richard's arguments. Being very sympathetic to Morgan's naturalistic approach, I believe a Jewish historian could write as good or maybe better a history of Catholicism as any Jesuit. It boils down, finally, to that old philosophical question, what is truth? Dale Morgan wrote to Juanita Brooks. There is no absolute or final definition of truth. It has emotional value for some people, intellectual values for others. Our confusions are consequent in some degree upon the fact that people try to square their emotional truths with their intellect, while their intellectual truths they try to invest with emotional meanings. One does not have to be a believer to write about a religion honestly, perceptively, and sympathetically, any more than Saunders' faith in the restored gospel should disqualify him from writing about its history. My personal experience suggests Mormons have an emotional, not an intellectual, bond to their faith. I never formed that bond, but I've had Arkansans born into a long tradition of hating Latter-day Saints say my work helped them understand and sympathize with my people. Even though I'm not a believer, I believe that being raised in Mormon culture, you acquire a distinct identity and attitude. And I often like to joke that being Mormon is worse than being Jewish. But even though I reject the religion, I very much accept and take pride in the culture and its traditions and appreciate what it has given me. We are all captives of our own experiences, beliefs, and yes, prejudices, which makes an objective approach to history very difficult, but also very necessary, Brig Madsen wrote. He was delighted when a reviewer of his prize-winning Patrick Edward Connor biography condemned its pro-Mormon biases, while a second charged that merely writing about, quote, such a bitter anti-Mormon displayed a pro-Mormon and anti-Mormon slant. Brig Madsen was, to my model, a perfect example of how important it is to write objective and fair history. Now, my firm belief that quackery began when the first knave met the first fool shows how much I am a captive of my Mormon upbringing. I found reading Mark Twain's Letters from the Earth and Roughing It almost 50 years ago enlightening and liberating, but the experience led me to regard Mormonism's truth claims in magic history as a collection of absurdities. As Bill Mulder pointed out, Joseph Smith couldn't have lifted the gold plates out of their cement box. Had they existed at all, they would have weighed more than 200 pounds. Now, I am profoundly aware of how much faith did to sustain all the pioneers of the borderland through trials that would destroy most people, to quote myself. I have much less respect for the exalted leader of frontier Mormonism than Dale Morgan, Bernard DeVoto, and Wallace Stegner did. But I share their immense admiration and sympathy for what the faith's rank and file endured and understand the power of the culture the Mormon people created with immense sacrifice. I would not exist if Joseph Smith had not evolved from scryer to seer to theologian. And I have many friends and admirable colleagues, notably Dave Bigler and Rick Turley, whose faith shapes the core of their being. As Morgan wrote, Juanita, if every member of the church united your feeling for the Mormon way of life with your intellectual objectivity and reasonableness, no religion on earth would rival Mormonism, and the kingdom of God would have a fair chance of early realization. Too often, historians forget their own history. I should say, too often, religious historians forget their own history. The current generation of faithful Mormon scholars seems blissfully unaware of the dark days before 1978, when the curse of Cain was sold as doctrine, and the LDS Church protected its historical collections like the United States Mint Police defend Fort Knox. Boyd K. Packer's crusade against honest history and the purge of 1993 is forgotten. Some of us who've survived what felt like a war for our people's history, remember a different world. Bigler, O'Neill, and Madsen shared entertaining stories about the old days when Will Lund stood guard over the sacred records in the old church office building and required researchers to show him their notes. "Now, we don't need that, do we, Brother Madsen?" Lund would say before tossing an offending note card into his circular file. Brigg didn't mind because he always made two sets of cards. Others would sequester entire documents, take them to their offices, make typescripts, and return the secret sources to the holy precincts. Leonard Arrington began his autobiography describing his visit to the church historian's office in 1946, recalling how Will Lund cracked San Pete Squarehead jokes and tried to gently persuade people to content themselves with examining materials that had already been published. The historian's office still try to hold out things on me, but I have nailed them so many things that I'm not afraid of them anymore, Winita Brooks told a colleague at the Huntington Library in 1954. She did not quarrel with them. I do not fight them. I don't criticize them. I can just laugh at them for the many silly things they do. When he showed me the 212 Indian letters Artist Partial had transcribed for the Kingdom in the West series, from the Brigham Young collection, Floyd O'Neill said, "I wonder where this stuff was when I was doing my PhD." While working on Blood of the Prophets in 1996, I was barred access to those very letter books. I later, of course, found back doors into the collection, but the censorship was immensely frustrating. Now, the age of silly little things in Mormon history is now over. When I began working at the Church History Library a quarter century ago, I became aware of how frustrated many of its excellent professional staff were with the policies limiting access to its collections, which are essential to telling the story of the Mormon people with honesty and understanding. We are at the dawn of a new age for Mormon history. For those of us who practice the craft of history, the internet and its dynamic search engines have streamlined, energized, and transformed the entire scope of the work we do. The best Mormon historians have convinced management of the archives that they have nothing to fear from their history, and that in an internet age, trying to hide the face colorful past is pointless. Brigg used to tell me he loved it when the church censored and restricted materials, because he said, then you knew exactly what you wanted to look at. This summer, the LDS Church Historical Department put the Brigham Young letterpress copybooks, 1844 to 1879, online, including every one of the letters the archives refused to show me in 1996. The church's Mormon Pioneer Overland Travel website has identified 52,467 individuals who crossed the Mormon Trail between 1847 and 1868, and has put the full text of 3,243 overland narratives, creating what is far and away the most dynamic trails historical resource in existence. Scholars occasionally deprecate documentary editing as a lesser and somehow inferior work, Brigg Madsen wrote, but I have found the research and writing involved to be just as demanding as conceiving and writing an original product. Amen to that. Sometimes it seems that no one ever learns anything from history. See the constant bitter and bloody tribal revolts Afghan tribesmen staged in Arcosia between 522 to 486 before Common Era to plague the Persian Empire. The vast amount of work that has gone into compiling the more than 6,000 pages of the Kingdom in the West series, which is a collection of the best of Brigham Young in many ways, often feels like a distraction to my career, not to mention an enormous waste of time and money. But maybe, just maybe, those 12 volumes helped inspire the LDS Church to liberate Brigham Young's letters and put them online. This Sunday, on the 10th anniversary of the national tragedy that has darkened all our lives, and on the 154th anniversary of another inhuman massacre, the National Register will take another step to recognize the historical significance of Utah's darkest day by declaring Mountain Meadows a national landmark. In the last decade, the LDS Church's handling of the massacre has changed dramatically. My books about the atrocity helped bring about this change, and I'm glad the Mormons now have their own story, since everybody has the right to tell their own history, however likely that history may appear to outsiders. Besides, as Richard White told me, when he heard how much money the corporation of the president was spending to refute Blood of the Prophets, he thought, what greater validation of his work could any historian ever hope for? Jared Farmer, whose Utah Valley book on Zion's Mount, Mormons, Indians, and the American Landscape, won the Parkman Prize a couple of years ago, called the church's book a consummate insider's history, and said mine was a victim's book, perhaps too much so. I was proud to tell the story of the men, women, and children brutally slaughtered at that remote oasis on the California Trail. And if Jared knew how pernicious and persistent the lies told about them still are, he'd understand why telling their side of the story was so important. History is not revealed truth. It's a process. My own understanding of Mountain Meadows has evolved dramatically over the last decade. The objections a member of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation made to the site's traditional Utah-centric nomination to the National Register cast a new light on the atrocity. He found the notion that this mass murder needed to be seen in the context of victimization of the LDS members weak and occasionally repugnant. Quote, innocent people were the victims of cold-blooded mass murder, and it is inappropriate to repeat an assertion that it is understandable or somehow justified. We don't interpret wounded knee by discussing how Euro-Americans had suffered at the hands of Native Americans during centuries of warfare. When at the site of a mass murder, the point of view of the murderers is made invalid by the cold-blooded nature of the crime. The perpetrators of such a heinous act forever abdicate their right to be understood when interpreting the historic site. Germans suffered terribly under the onerous terms of the Versailles Treaty, but we never bring that up at Auschwitz. That would be a tasteless affront to the victims of mass murder. Now, I had planned to wrap this up by bragging about my status as the world's luckiest historian, or questioning why Mormons go so far out of the way to justify the reprehensible actions of their prophets. Joseph Smith's opportunistic exploitation of teenage girls strikes me as no more defensible than Warren Jeffs does, and Brigham Young's diversion of men and teams from the handcart rescue to haul his 13,000-pound steam engine and 6 tons of booze from Fort Bridger to Salt Lake in October 1856 makes the worst Provo Ponzi scheme look downright benevolent. But I want to end on a higher note and bear my testimony of humanity and hope. And I want to start with an account of how we said goodbye to another one of our mentors, and I hope I can, when it comes my own time, I can say goodbye with as much grace and courage as another beloved mentor, Wilbur L. Rusho, did last winter. The last time Laura and I saw these great historians, a few days before Bud's death, an endless stream of memories constantly engaged his mind, and he expected they would until his mind ceased remembering. Bud Rusho's bravery confirmed my belief that life is a gift, and like Brig Madsen, I look forward to another opportunity. For many of my generation, it's easy to imagine there's no hell below us and above us only sky. For most of us, it's harder to imagine the end of our personal existence. I see no reason why nature would need to continue my consciousness after I died, and I doubt she does. My grandmother Cassie expanded that view some considerably when she explained, "I don't care about surviving death, but I can't bear the thought of never seeing the people I love again." I believe she hit upon the reason people embrace religion and the hope it brings. One of the greatest Christians I have ever known, my grandfather Frank Bailey, lived to be so old he felt like God had forgotten him. And he confided in me that he looked forward to dying because then he, would learn if all the crazy stuff he'd believed in for almost 100 years was actually true. I believe in science and humanism as deeply as he believed in Mormonism. The purpose of life is obviously to make more life, which goes a long way to explaining why I spent half my life thinking about sex. I believe we should celebrate the joy that life brings us and accept great death with courage and grace. Certainly, I hope I can do as well as Bud Rusho did. But like Brig Madsen, I look forward to the opportunity of venturing into the unknown, where there may be a God with body parts and passions, or more likely, nothing but this temporal life, where all of us should be helping each other in the pursuit of happiness toward a good life in the present. Thank you very much. Oh, sure.
Well, we got a few more minutes where we can take, Will's agreed to take some questions from the audience. I guess I'll move this mic down to the bottom stairs. John and Zilpha's agreed to take some mics to people if they want to ask some questions as well. So we'll go with that.
I blubber awfully. I apologize. Well, Bob, you want to share anything about your uncle with us? You told me a bit about how he'd show up in Salt Lake at Christmas time with armloads of packages, books mostly, for the nieces and nephews. And he also told me how much he loved his mother and how much he cared for her.
Yeah, he really loved his mother. We all loved her. We called her Baba. The first grandchild couldn't pronounce grandma, and that's how it came out.
Bama?
Baba. B-A-B-A. Almost Jewish in nature, you know? But there were probably, let me think, there were probably 14 kids, nieces and nephews of Uncle Dale. And he would come every Christmas for a family Christmas party, and he'd get off the plane with bags of books, and he would have picked a book, and they had nothing to do with Western history usually, but he'd pick a book that was specific to each child, and bring those and give them at Christmas. I still have some of those books that I got from him, and they were a treasured gift. I usually. Getting a book at Christmas was kind of, for a kid, is kind of like getting new clothes or the bunny pajamas or something. But those books were treasured because they came from Uncle Dale. And my grandma took great care of Uncle Dale as from the time of his meningitis on through his graduation from college and his first books with the WPA. There was just a special bond between them, and later on he took great care of her as well, and he was just my favorite uncle. He taught me to play chess. He was a state chess champion. He had a mind that was unbelievable. As a child, I sat in the Historical Society when he came and listened to him answer questions from Von Brody and Juanita Brooks and a dozen other historians who were writing books and wanted information, and he gave it freely. He didn't. It was immediate in his mind. He could almost tell you the page number of a diary where a certain event was taking place. But I have very fond recollections. We visited him in his apartment. We had brother and three sisters and I, and my mom and dad stayed with him in a two-bedroom apartment that was nothing but bookshelves. And we stayed with him while we visited San Francisco. He taught us how to eat shrimp. He really was kind of a Renaissance man in a lot of ways too. And you know, he had a lot of turbulence, I think, as a teenager and growing up as a young adult, but as I knew him, he seemed very much at peace. My entire recollection from, you know, in the early 50s to, I was on a mission for the LDS Church in Germany when he died, and it was a very sad day for me when I got the news. So those are some recollections.
Bob told me something I didn't know, which was Dale repeatedly took the Utah State Chess Championship, held at the Utah Fair every year.
Yeah, he did. I think it was just after college when he was writing his first books. Yeah. And he says, you got to be able to think five moves ahead. And I thought, gee, if I could think one ahead, I'd be in good shape.
He could.
Yeah. I have a quick question, since I'm a question whore.
Yes.
You say that your stance on Brigham Young's involvement with the Mountain Meadows Massacre might have softened or has changed.
I didn't say that.
Okay. Okay, then how about this? How is your view towards Brigham Young now? Has it been changed at all from what you've written in Blood of the Prophets? Do you still see, do you hold him in the same light then as you do now?
It was Ecclesiastes, I think, who said, he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And the more I have learned about Brigham Young, the more appalled I become. I did an article on handcart immigration in which I found out that he had diverted critical resources from the rescue of the Willie and Martin companies to help haul in a freight train that was at Fort Bridger, right between both of the parties. Yeah, it was just a big steam engine. Well, no, it was a steam engine, glass, and groceries. And it was when I found out that I often wondered, I said, well, now wait a minute. The Mormons had hauled a sugar-making factory across the plains in 1853, and Brigham Young was really mad at John Taylor because they only got it to Echo Canyon, or to where Echo is today. They had to camp it, leave it up there all winter. But they didn't know how to put it together when they got it to Salt Lake. But I thought, well, what is, what's the harm in leaving a steam engine at Fort Bridger? Well, it wasn't the steam engine that Brigham Young was worried about. It was the 6 tons of liquor that was in the groceries. And that's why he sent orders, and poor Frank Woolley, who wrote about it, and in a memoir that I think was written explicitly to leave a record of these orders, and had them go over and take oxen from the Woolley Company and Teamsters and haul it into Salt Lake. Now, in terms of Mountain Meadows, one of the things I found, it didn't make it into Innocent Blood, which is a documentary history of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, was a statement by Peter Schurz, which the church revealed in their found during their research for their book, Massacre at Mountain Meadows. And Schurz is a fascinating frontier Mormon character, didn't participate in the massacre, was living at Harmony and picked up everything. And one of the statements that struck me was, he said, the leaders down there wanted to kill every American coming through. That was certainly what they intended to do. Now, where did they get that idea? Well, they got it from George A. Smith. And I think that looking back, that what happens is Brigham Young wants an Indian incident, which the church's own experts acknowledge. I've got a quote from Ron Walker in which he says, yeah, they had a political strategy of sending Indians to attack immigrant trains to show that they controlled the overland road. It was a political tactic, and we talk about that a lot in Mormon Rebellion. But I believe that, Brigham Young says to Smith, carry verbal orders down there and tell them, we want every American passing through southern Utah killed. And that's why Mountain Meadows happens, because that's the operating model. That's the word of the prophet, and that's what they're going to do. And that's what happens. And you've got all this falderal about how it's a bunch of real bad local guys doing this real bad thing. Well, any one of them who would have stood up and said, no, we can't murder these women and children. There are 80 women and children out there, and we're not going to kill them. One man standing up and saying that might have stopped the event. But they had their orders, and they'd been thumped in, obey, 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 and they carried them out. And I believe that if they hadn't gotten the letter that Brigham Young wrote on September 10th, which lets him know that bad things are happening down there, they would have kept on and killed the party right behind the Fancher party, and word would probably have reached California much later, and it would have been easier to cover up because there wouldn't have been so many pesky peripheral eyewitnesses. But that's just me, and it's hard to, you can't prove it historically, but the circumstantial evidence I find compelling and overwhelming.
Judge. Yes. Judge Drummond, I'm in the middle of your book there, Will, and Hal Schindler on the Vodoya program really vilified Judge Drummond. He did come here as one of the federal officers, with a woman that wasn't his wife, and he's the prototypical scapegoat, if you will.
Oh yeah.
And Schindler supported that. Your book takes a different view. Can you elaborate on that one for a bit for us?
Well, according to the old line Mormon history, the whole Utah War was caused by Judge Drummond and a couple of other unsavory characters. And there were, Drummond was an unsavory character, and there were any number of them. But Drummond had, why did they send Drummond out here? Was it to persecute the Mormons? No, they sent Drummond out because he had relatives who were Mormons in Salt Lake. That's how he got the job. And he is quite the piece of work, but The government itself explains in an executive document published early in 1858 with hundreds of examples of why Mormons are in virtual rebellion against the United States. They're encouraging Indian tribes to be loyal to Brigham Young, not to the federal government. Young is Indian agent at the time. And I once ran down the theory that Bigler lays out in Forgotten Kingdom, which is a Kingdom in the West volume, of what caused the Utah War, which was about a decade of provocative behavior. And Brigham Young's statements like he was going to hang any federal official that came out here and offended him. And I ran that down for Hal Schindler, and I said, Hal, isn't that pretty much how the Utah War started? And he looked up and goes, no. And I said, well, Hal, how did the Utah War start? And Hal said, you can read it in my book. And I said, well, let me read your book. Give me what you've written on this. He looked at me and said, I haven't written it. And I've often believed that Schindler couldn't write his Utah War book, which he worked on for going on 40 years, because he couldn't justify making Brigham Young a hero. And if Brigham Young wasn't a hero, what did that make Porter Rockwell? And Hal loved Porter Rockwell. So he never did. He had a couple of draft chapters on his computer when he died, but that was all he'd done on his Utah War history. And he never would explain to me if he really did still think that Judge Drummond was the cause of all the problems. Any other questions? The question is, where should the next generation of Utah historians, I think you mean, be looking? And I think right now we should be looking at the Civil War. There's a great book called The Saints of the Union by a fellow named Long. What's Long's first name? Was it Gary or E.B. Young? Yeah. But it's a very, very good book. But Gary Maxwell, who's written a brilliant book on George R. Maxwell, Civil War hero, a veteran who was all shot up and winds up being the territorial marshal in Utah. And that's one of the most brilliant, sympathetic portraits of what it's like being a disabled. It's the best portrait by a physician, a surgeon, distinguished surgeon, of what it was like to be a disabled veteran in the 19th century. And he's now working on Robert Baskin, and he's been going through those online Brigham Young letters about the Civil War, and they paint a very different picture than the traditional Brigham Young is great American picture. And I will admit, I am not a fan of Brigham Young, and I am an iconoclast, and I'm proud that I've done so much to tarnish the great man's reputation. But I also would not write a book about him, because I will not write a book about somebody I don't like. And I don't have to admire them. I've written a huge volume of virtual biography of Sam Brannan, and Brannan's a despicable human being in many ways, but he's also totally lovable, and I quite like Sam. And I know there are many people who love Brigham Young, and he's one of those few men who women will fall in love with even though he's dead. but I just don't share that bond, shall we say. But there, at the same time, I've been reading John Turner's Mind Your Business, a biography of Brigham Young. And it's a brilliant book. Harvard University Press is going to publish it next year. And John is a meticulous scholar. He's a professor at the University of South Alabama and a distinguished scholar of American religions. And he's quite fond of Brigham Young, but he's also a very good historian, and he certainly incorporates a lot of the warts that have traditionally been removed from portraits of Brigham Young. But I think those letter books are full of not merely biography or details or military history. They're full of all kinds of history, because you can use them for social history and what were medical beliefs. Brigham Young gives people advice about how the curative, in those Civil War letters, he talks about the curative potency of asparagus and a whole bunch of bizarre folk remedies. And the Mormon records are like that because they're so huge and they cover so many different topics. The last volumes of The Kingdom in the West will include a 49er journal, which has mostly been edited by the great Death Valley historians, Leroy and Gene Johnson. And the two Dale Morgan volumes, and then finally, a book of Indian letters that I'm working on with Greg Thompson and Floyd O'Neill. And I may push them out and say I want to do it all by myself. But we've got all the material, and that will be my last book on Mormon history. Bigler's pointed out to me that Rugged and Mountainous is a far and away a better book than anything I've written about Mormonism. And I am really tired of the conflict that accompanies it, and especially the insults that people say the most vicious things about me, and they're lies. They're just flat-out lies. And I understand why they do it, because my history challenges their faith. But it's not done maliciously, and I am not fabricating history. If I'm a charlatan, as I've been accused, I am the world's least successful charlatan in terms of finances. And when my grandfather retired as the Bagley and Bancott Bagley, or when he died, Scott Matheson wrote my dad and my uncle a letter and said, "Your father was the most ethical attorney I ever met." Now, to me, that was as high an honor as Wilbur Grant Bagley ever got. And when my dad retired from being three terms of mayor of Oceanside, California, I had two different contractors come up to me and say, "Your dad was the only honest politician I ever met." So I come from a family that really values its integrity. And I find the assaults on my character to be despicable. But what are you going to do about it? I think my work speaks for itself.
Okay, well, I'll back you up. Every time I say to people, "Will Bagley's a nice guy," they say, "Liar, liar."
I'm sure they believe it. Yes, Roger.
I defend you all the time. You talked a little bit about the letter books being put up online by the church and about the archives being open now and the impact of the internet. But the question is, do you think they could close again? Or do you
Well, Heber J. Grant once said that Rudger Clausen would never become prophet. He was the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, because Rudger was such a complete jerk that God would never make him prophet. But we don't know about how the Lord feels about Boyd Packer. And you know, the oldest guy wins strategy is not a model for dynamic leadership. but it probably has served the LDS Church right, because real eccentrics, shall we say, like Joseph Fielding Smith, and absolute wackos like Ezra Taft Benson, are too old and debilitated by the time they get to be prophet to really do the harm they could do if, say, they were dynamic 40-year-olds with high senses of themselves. So we don't. There is a saying, though, up in the church offices that things change when you get a new pharaoh, and a new pharaoh could absolutely reverse current policies on access to Mormon archives. I hope we don't see that, but we might. Although it may have gone too far. The church has shown that it's no longer afraid of its history. They no longer believe that if they reveal the darker side of Mormon history, the human side often, that people will apostatize en masse. Because people leave the Mormon church all the time, and other people come in, and it goes on and on. But I think there's a much better appreciation that their history isn't a threat. They've got other bigger threats to worry about at this point, I think. Yes?
In one of my brother's books, I believe it was Danes, and a picture of Danes on his porch. In the back, there's a couple of black folks.
Yes.
You know, there's a side issue in that story. But
fascinating.
What was the issue of it? Were they regular slaves? Or
The question was, in Blood of the Prophets, there's a picture of William Dame on his porch, and behind him is a black couple who were servants, no doubt. And they were probably slaves. I'm not sure. I've never seen any commentary on it. And some people say there was a black man with the Fancher party, but there's not a single documentary reference to it. The Fanchers had slaves. The Bakers had slaves. Did they have slaves with them? If there were black casualties at Mountain Meadows, nobody mentioned them. But Utah was the only slave territory. It was the only American territory, including New Mexico, where vast numbers of Indians were enslaved in a variety of ways, that formalized and legalized slavery. Well, California, Indian slavery went on for years and years. But Utah put it in the legal code. And I come to think of it, I think New Mexico had it wasn't called a slave law, but I think Utah's was. But Utah always had a couple of hundred black people, and they were usually servants. Brigham Young's Pioneer Company included three slaves that had been given to Brigham Young, often as tithing or some other option. But I grew up with some of their descendants in East Mill Creek, and it just shows how surprising the history of the West is, and how history isn't about what happened, it's about the records we have of what happened.
Is that about it?
Anybody? One last question. Well, Brigham Young was a pretty good craftsman. He was admired for his skill as a carpenter and glazier and painter in upstate New York before he took up religion. And there's a hilarious account in On the Way to Somewhere Else, Mike Homer's volume in Kingdom in the West, of Brigham Young escorting European visitors through his extensive estate and the tabernacle, and showing them all the things that he designed and invented. And it's a funny, funny episode. And he claimed to have designed the wagon wheel. There's a big wheel chandelier that lighted the tabernacle. He said, "I designed that. I designed the tabernacle. I designed this." And he was a pretty good hand and a pretty good folk architect. But I'm not sure that he would be considered an inventive or engineering genius, you know, certainly in our own day. But he was a very gifted man. I will not argue with that. A variety of gifts. Well, thanks so much for coming. Let me plug my books once more. They only brought a handful of these books, and there were only a handful of them printed. I believe this book is expensive. It's $45. So are most of these later volumes of this. But it's going to be a collector's item. It was the book editor's choice in this month's Atlantic Monthly. And I still can't believe that happened, that I got one of my humble books reviewed in the Atlantic Monthly. And it's a real good review, too. But we've got this. I've got a complete set of Kingdom of the West if anybody has a lot of money. And these are more. This is the latest Bigler Bagley opus. And it's only $35. And the autographs are free. And next Friday, you can come up to Eve Dickinson's territory at Fort Douglas and see this book get the best book award from the Mormon Histories. No, from the Utah State Historical Society. Hey, thanks so much.
I just wanted to give a quick shout out to those that helped set this up, Robin, Amy, John Zilfa, and all you guys for coming. I really appreciate it to support Will and his fantastic endeavors. Can you join me in one last round of applause for Will Bagley?